This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. And I believe we are joined by Tony Leah of Unifor, General Motors, Oshawa. Are you there, Tony?
I am, Phil. Hi.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. I want to tell our listeners right off the top again, you have a new book. It's being announced by Baraka Books. And it is titled The Truth About the 37 Oshawa General GM Strike. And we're going to ask you about that. But I guess, first of all, we've been through your expertise and your research on the matter, trying to keep track of the topic of electrical vehicles. And by the way, I hate all these acronyms with all the EVN, NVC, you know, and so the reader is supposed to be all up to speed on what all these terms are, but we're entering a kind of new language area. But at any rate, big decision is expected from the Canadian government. Everybody says they already know what it's going to be, as in the editorials are saying, why doesn't Canada just go ahead and do it? 100%. Surtax? But anyway, 100%, they want to make the Chinese vehicles 100% more expensive than they actually are, and they want them to do it soon because the Americans have already done it, which means that we're going to do it. By the way, do you have any opinion about why this they're putting themselves through this torturous process of saying they're looking into it?
I'm not really sure. I guess it's partly an exercise in ramping up expectations and, you know, allowing for everybody to pile on and attack China in one way or another, because that's certainly what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, Unifor, the union with which you've been associated, and of course, you not only were you Unifor, you were once Canadian Auto Worker, and you were once United Auto Workers. So you've been up and down the valleys and all that, but you're still GM, and it's still the same union. They issued quite a long statement, and my understanding is you didn't actually agree with it. Tell us about that statement.
Unifor made a submission to the government consultation in which they wholeheartedly endorsed the idea that China is a threat. They keep using the word threat, the most dangerous threat, they say, to the auto industry, the Canadian auto industry, such as it is, which we should really talk about how Canadian it is at the moment. And in that presentation, Unifor absolutely endorsed the position of the U.S. government in imposing unprecedented severe tariffs on the importation of vehicles assembled in China, electric vehicles assembled in China, and a whole range of associated products, parts, electric batteries, raw materials associated with batteries, steel, aluminum. It's quite a wide-ranging projected restriction on Chinese associated materials and manufactured items, which is it's completely a protectionist approach, which is not something that unions historically have tied mm-hmm. themselves to. And if you look through the whole document, and as you said, it is an extensive document, I can't find anything in it that is specifically aimed at recommendations that would benefit workers in terms of wages, unionization, or anything else. It's really, they keep saying it's on behalf of workers, but what they're advocating is on behalf of some auto companies which are currently producing vehicles in Canada. So it's a pro-company policy recommendation, I would say, which I guess in some ways makes Unifor a kind of company union.
Mm-hmm. Sad to say, it does have that ring. I mean, where they are, I mean, are they out of step at all, any way, shape, or form, with GM, Ford, and the other guys? Appear to be saying exactly the same thing.
They are saying exactly the same thing.
And Mr. Polyev said some of these things, right?
Pierre Polyev's comments were to make exactly the same recommendations of to be in lockstep with the United States and impose a 100% tariff on Chinese assembled vehicles.
If they worry about Polyev finding appeal amongst working class Canadians, which they call the middle class, working class Canadians, they have given him, he has stolen the march on them, because he can say to the workers, I told you to do that a long time ago. I'm protecting you, but your guys waited around. Hello? Oh, I think Tony fainted when I asked him that question. This is the Taylor Report. We'll get Tony back in a moment, I hope. Just to continue on that, I urge people, you can find this online, by the way, the Unifor statement. I have to say, I'm not aware at the moment, and we'll make sure we clarify, but what is being said, that it differs, if at all, from the NDP or the Bloc or the Green Party. The Green Party is so busy snuffing each other out or throttling each other in a closet that they can't be bothered to talk about saving the environment. It's really at a time when something really major is taking place, and this has the green phenomenon is the most important. People say they want to protect the environment. You would think that the Green Party would think of something else to do than fight each other in the dark. We've got Tony back. Sorry about that, Tony.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I was saying, actually, that by delaying they've allowed Polyev to steal the march a bit with Canadian workers. If he wants to make the appeal that we need tariffs and we have to be tough on China, which the government eventually will do, they've opened the door for him to put on a show that he's on the side of Canadian workers, right?
Yes. And if they had been making recommendations which would directly benefit workers in Canada, then he wouldn't be jumping on board. But the things that Unifor is advocating are to do what the U.S. government has done, which is to protect their domestic industry, which is not particularly a pro-working class approach.
Yeah, no, of course not. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, they between the Canadian government and Unifor, they're advocating a policy which does allow Polyev to jump in and jump on the bandwagon and try to carve.
Yes, rather like Trump, actually, the same kind of situation.
Sure, because really
now says there's not going to be any. He says there won't be any support for electrical vehicles in North America.
Right, and both the Biden government and the Trump government import tariffs and on China and a wide range of restrictive trade practices. So there's not much distinction there either.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really striking about the Unifor proposal is that it goes beyond just proposing tariffs to going into a very long attack on China. and claiming that China has uses forced labor and have a wide range of attacks on Chinese government policies, and they call on the Canadian government to empower Canada Border Services to block imports from China if they're suspected of having any association with forced labor. And they explicitly use the term reverse onus, so that the onus would be on the company importing the whatever the goods are to prove that there was no forced labor involved in their manufacture.
Yes.
It's really a bizarre approach. And, you know, to empower a border agent who's, you know, been told Chinese are bad and you have to restrict their goods, to restrict them without evidence.
Yeah, and, well, again, I don't know, so I guess we can use this term, political class. Those who make up the commentariat, follow all these things, they are allowing, not even questioning, Unifor relying on basic U.S. intelligence cutout operations to as authorities. You know, around the world, Human Rights Watch is not regarded with any respect because it butts into other countries. It writes reports based on anonymous sources and then has conclusions, and then it is passed off as believable. And Unifor seems to think that's fine. I mean, if Human Rights Watch says it, which Human Rights Watch is financed in part by the U.S. government, mm-hmm. but they don't point this out. Let's put it another way, they don't do their own homework. They go to established so-called human rights bodies, almost all of them located in Western capitals, obedient to U.S. policy. There's no concept of actually trying to determine the truth. It's passing on the specialized opinion of entities that interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, frankly.
Yes, absolutely. The only sources they use for their statements against China are from these NGOs, which are primarily based in the U.S. or support U.S. foreign policy, have no particular concern for international labor solidarity. And it's really I found it quite shocking the degree to which they repeat bold sneers against China without that have certainly not been haven't been supported by any real investigation or fair look at what's going on there, and it's only designed to benefit corporations that that are for their own interest, not for the interest of workers.
Yeah.
The quote that I wanted to mention is from a person at Environmental Defense, which is a body advocating for a transition to more sustainable elements and energy, or the transition to electric vehicles. So this person, Nate Wallace, the program manager of Clean Transportation and Environmental Defense, says that the tariff proposal he sees as a deliberate play by auto manufacturers to delay introducing affordable EVs. It's just so bald-faced what their strategy is, he said. They want to keep out China to make sure that the budget EV market niche never gets filled, so they can keep EV to a marginal luxury market, and then they can keep selling gas-guzzling vehicles, which make them more money. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. We can see that GM, Ford, Stellantis are delaying their switch to electric vehicles, actually, because they make more money at the moment, much higher profit margins, on selling SUVs and pickup trucks. And so they want to protect that market and their profitability. It's not in the benefit of Canadian consumers. It's not in the benefit of environmental progress. And it's not particularly in the benefit of workers. It's in the benefit of these corporations, none of which are Canadian. I had mentioned before. You know, so why are we advocating that the Canadian government implement policies which are going to be to the benefit of American companies like General Motors or Ford, or a company like Stellantis, which is an Italian-French company headquartered in Hoofddorp, Netherlands?
Mm-hmm. By the way, tell us again the name of that individual and organization that made that statement. Who is that?
Nate Wallace is the program manager of clean transportation at Environmental Defense, which is based in Ottawa.
No, it's a really important statement. It couldn't be more accurate, in my opinion. That's and let's talk about the kind of a related matter. Incidentally, I read the report, thanks to you, and it's people can find it online. They actually take a very patronizing view of anybody that's not them. We on this show, we're talking actually to you about it.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me? Hi, Tony, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Oh, okay. Because I'm going to quote Blinken, Biden. It's very important you hear what Biden said. But Biden's referred to AFL-CIO as his domestic NATO. So it's curious. Here we are. I'm reading this report by Unifor, and they talk about, there are unions in China, but you see, they're just prisoners of the Chinese government. But there's an echo, because talking to you previous about some of these things, they talk about the Mexican trade unions the same way. Like, there's no free union except themselves. They're the real deal. Everybody else is a phony, right?
Yep.
And that's really quite I find that galling to have to put up with, since they're in lockstep with the manufacturers. And with the polluters, frankly, they're not doing anything about the polluters. But since I've raised Mexico, one of the items I noticed, it was in the article that you, or piece that you referred to, is that since 2022, 29 new Chinese-owned factories have opened in Mexico. Now, they're a trade partner. We have this, you know, Canada, U.S., Mexico, we're all buddies, the three amigos, they tell us. So our amigo has opened 29 Chinese-owned factories. How come we can't open, say, two or three?
Yes. And wouldn't that be of more benefit to Canadian workers than imposing tariffs?
How come that subject isn't even raised? I mean, they're all so glad. They say, oh, we have these companies here. None of those companies are Canadian companies. We don't make a Canadian car. So why doesn't somebody say, well, how about we'll let the Chinese come and make some cars, and the Canadian auto workers have more members and make more money?
Yep, and it's a striking omission from the policy recommendations that Unifor has made. And, you know, they seem to be much more intent on developing this outlook that China is a threat somehow.
That's a political estimation, by the way. What's that got to do with the trade unions?
It's a political outlook which is tied in with the foreign policy needs of the U.S. government, not anything to do with workers in Canada or the United States. And you can see that really in that report when they go to great lengths to portray electric vehicles assembled in China as some kind of a security threat because of their computer connectivity systems, which is the whole report reads like something a throwback to the worst days of.
Yes, well, one of the co-authors was George Orwell, I think. The car is spying on me. It's sitting there across the street, but it's actually counting, checking how much water I'm putting on my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess also targeting us. Incidentally, there's never been any evidence of this, we should point out, for all the talk. It's like the Huawei thing. Everybody said, oh, they're spying. Nobody ever showed that they were.
No.
So it's very important. The only way to have a conclusive argument is to provide no evidence.
Then everybody says,
it's obvious. It's so obvious we don't need evidence.
And meanwhile, the real goal is to prop up the insane profit margins of people who are marketing large SUVs and huge pickup trucks they make $15,000 or $20,000 profit per vehicle, and they want to prevent anybody from bringing in vehicles that would be more affordable.
In the room where they're making the money, they would find our conversation hilarious.
Yeah.
They say, are you kidding me? I'm going to give up $15,000 a vehicle in order to have a clean environment? Ho, ho, ho. tell them quickly. There's the Oakville. They said Oakville's going to start up. We're going to go EV. And everybody was handshaking, had their pictures taken, and thought it was great. But then they said, well, there's a little glitch. So what happened?
As a number of these companies have done, have been pushing back their transition to electric vehicles because they want to keep making profits on these big gas guzzlers. So they said that the transition to electric vehicles at the Oakville plant, instead of happening in a year, was going to happen in 3 years. And the workers would be on layoff in the meantime. So, of course, they weren't happy with that. Unifor said they weren't happy with that, and they negotiated a deal with Ford, which I guess is what Ford probably wanted anyway, which is that instead of switching to electric vehicles, they're now going to be building very large, heavy-duty pickup trucks for commercial buyers, primarily, in Oakville. Instead of 3,000 jobs, there's going to be 1,800 jobs. Instead.
Hello? Wow. Well, okay. Just continuing on that point, we'll see if we can get him back because we've got to ask him about his book. We were speaking Tony Lea of Unifor, and he's many years a veteran on the plant floor, but also a historian who's written a very important book about the 37th strike, the truth about the strike. On this matter of the vehicles, I have a particular bias that galls me. I think they show us what they really think of us and think of the environment when they produce gas guzzlers instead of EVs. If you notice, we're always seeing a large gas guzzling vehicle traveling at high speed and on country roads and turning off into the wilderness and skidding sideways with people having a good time. I think that the auto manufacturers are elbowing us in the ribs saying, this is what you really want to do. You want to rip up the environment. You don't care about the environment. And let the devil take the hindmost. Let's make the money, etc. You know, one of the most popular country songs was Faster Horses, Younger Women, More Money. And if you want to know what is driving American politics and Donald Trump, listen to the song. And don't kid yourself. That is what they promised the Americans. You can have the whole damn continent, and you can rip it up if you want, including killing the locals. This is the Taylor Report, and we are speaking to Tony Leah. Tony, we better talk about your book.
It's okay.
The Truth About 37. Well, okay. Now, by the way, now this is a story of industrial union pulling off a win in 1937, establishing what became what is now Unifor. There had been attempts to organize previous, right?
Sure. And it's always a feature of workers wherever they're exploited to try to organize. And in Oshawa in particular, there's a long history of labor organizing. It goes back to the 1800s, and the Knights of Labor were quite big in the Oshawa area. In 1883, they held a big demonstration that was a mile long, and people came from all across the province to march in Oshawa in support of the labor issues and as part of the Knights of Labor. Mm-hmm. And they had floats, and they were demonstrating their work on the floats. And on one of the floats, they were actually, they had a furnace, and they were molding medallions out of cast iron and handing them out to the crowd that said, Knights of Labor demonstration, 1883, quite an amazing thing. And so there's that long, long history in Oshawa that eventually led to the unionization of General Motors plant in 1937.
Well, let me ask you about that language. They were organizing. The people wanted unions were arguing actually with each other, because most, I think you tell me, the leading elements had a concept of organizing by skill or trade, and this idea of industrial unions, which I guess that Wobblies at one point really represented that as a kind of a vision, but that's where there was a kind of a conflict internally to people who wanted unions, right? And it was a result of eventually in industrial unions, if you could talk about it.
That's right. The unions that became established after the Knights of Labor kind of fell apart, and after the Wobblies were repressed out of existence, were primarily craft-based. And their organization was the American Federation of Labor, and they tried to protect their craft. So the first attempt to organize GM in Oshawa in 1928, they formed a union under the aegis of the AFL, but then they were told that they had to divide it up because, every craft union had to have its jurisdiction protected, and they couldn't have a union that represented all of the workers at GM in one union. And so the idea of industrial unionism was, became much more of a need for the workers there. And that was part of the background to 1937, that, they were intent on having a union that would represent everybody. And by 1937, of course, the CIO existed, had been founded a couple of years earlier, out of parts of the AFL. And so that really provided the basis for a successful organizing effort in Oshawa.
Who were the elements? Was that John L. Lewis? Who was the element that cracked the notion of the AFL?
John L. Lewis was leader of the mine workers and was a leading advocate of organizing the ununionized industries in North America, primarily steel and mining, mining was part of the mine workers, but steel industry and the big manufacturing industries, auto and rubber and so on, were not unionized. And John L. Lewis and some others were advocating that the AFL undertake to organize the unorganized workers, the ununionized workers. And when the AFL rejected that proposal, they formed a committee for industrial organization within the AFL. So that's where the initial CIO come from. But the other AFL affiliates kicked them out over that. They said, you're not allowed to do that. And so they eventually became an independent labor federation. And that idea of the CIO really gained a lot of attention from workers during the middle of the Depression. And particularly auto workers took up that idea, formed the United Auto Workers, and took on the big corporations. And, you know, the really astounding event that excited people all across North America and probably across the world was the occupation of the GM facilities in Flint, Michigan, at the end of 1936. And they occupied the plants in Flint for 44 days before they forced GM to recognize the union. So that really established the CIO and the UAW.
And
that was the you know, the defining event of 1937. And it was only a couple of weeks after the success at Flint, the success of the Flint, the sit-down strike at Flint, that workers in Oshawa received a charter from the UAW to undertake organizing of the GM plant in Oshawa.
Well, that addresses the matter of, well, what is the truth in your title? And you, if since the title says the truth about the GM strike of 37, what was the false story?
Starting in the early 1970s, there was a historian, academic named Irving Abella, who wrote about the history of the CIO in Canada, and particularly the history of the 1937 strike in Oshawa, which really was the breakthrough for CIO organizing in Canada. And he presented a thesis about that strike, which became widely accepted in academia and beyond, and that has not been challenged for the last 50 years. And a lot of his thesis was a tremendous misrepresentation of what actually happened. He claimed that the CIO actually provided no support for the workers in Oshawa at all, and that they would have been better off.
He actually said nothing. In other words, it was all from the other side of the border. It was just rhetoric and no money and no organizing. Is that right?
In fact, he said they bamboozled the workers in Oshawa. He claims they lied to them by promising them support that they never delivered.
He kind of sounds like the premier of Ontario at the time.
Hepburn, that's exactly what Premier Hepburn was arguing in trying to defeat the strike. You're absolutely correct. You know, 40 years later, 35 years later, Abella was picking up that idea and trying to present that as the what actually happened. And as my book shows, I think in a very detailed way, that it could not have been more different. The UAW, which was in the midst of the most incredible battles and war with the auto companies across the United States, at one point during the battle in Oshawa, they had 18 different sit-down strikes in Detroit that they were, you know, trying to coordinate and deal with. They were facing police battles and threats of injunctions and jailings and all of this incredible organizing going on. But at the same time, they gave great support and attention to the strike in Oshawa of 3,700 workers. The president of the UAW came to Oshawa twice during the 16-day strike. They had discussions at the International Executive Board of the UAW about how important the strike was and the need to support it, both by sending organizers, by being prepared to raise money if it was needed, but most importantly, by negotiating directly with GM headquarters, because, of course, the Oshawa plant was a subsidiary of GM headquartered in Detroit, and the leaders of the UAW met numerous times with the executives of GM in Detroit to ensure that they would see that the union in Oshawa was recognized and achieved the same contract elements that UAW had won with GM in the U.S. So that was tremendous support, considering it was just one small plant. They had over 100,000 members in the United States at the time. But they did not neglect the workers in Oshawa. And I think even more important than that was the type of union that they were trying to build, the kind of union organizing that could occupy plants and fight off the police for 44 days by mobilizing the workers in the plant and by mobilizing workers to support it outside the plant. That approach to organizing is really what workers in Canada needed and which excited them and which they wanted to be part of.
And by the way, if people have the idea, of course, there was momentum, and it was, I mean, it was so dramatic, the idea of to sit in the plant, to occupy the plant, it just captured the imagination of so many people. But not every time was it a success, and Mitch Hepburn and the Ontario government and police, et cetera, pretty rough on people. Was it in Windsor where they really physically roughed them up?
Well, in Sarnia.
Sarnia, pardon me.
Yeah, there was a strike at the Holmes Foundry in Sarnia, and some workers there occupied it. This was very shortly after the Flint sit-down victory, and they wanted to organize as part of the CAO. And the company organized a vigilante group in the town of anti-union people, and they attacked the sit-down strikers violently, and they were armed with axe handles and all kinds of things. They were beating people up. They threw somebody off the roof of the plant. I think 50 people were injured, and the police stood by and watched. And it was just almost a massacre of workers. There was some housing near the plant where workers lived, and some of them were running to get away from this vigilante mob. But the mob followed them and broke into their homes in this little workers' community and were dragging them out and beating them.
The Sarnia.
In Sarnia. And, with the police just, kind of standing by whistling or something. And when that was raised in the legislature the next day by the one CCF member of the legislature at the time, Sam Lawrence, Hepburn said, "Well, I have no sympathy with the sit-down strikers. They're breaking the law." He says, "I more or less have sympathy with the people that dragged them out of the plant."
Yes, and went into their homes and beat them.
And beat them. In fact, after they evicted those workers from the plant, the people that evicted them, the company put them to work making blackjacks out of lengths of hose and melted lead, and putting long poles in furnaces to heat up the tips so that they could use them against the workers if the workers tried to return. Hepburn said that was a good thing. That was certain, the atmosphere that workers were organizing in.
It wasn't a cakewalk.
No.
Yeah. If you wanted a union, you had to fight for it.
When they started organizing in Oshawa, then Hepburn said, "Well, this is the CIO, and we're going to stop them. They're not going to come across the border. These are communists and revolutionaries."
And the leader was John L. Lewis.
John L.
Lewis versus Hepburn. But Annabella echoed again. He played down or mocked the role of communists or left wingers, if we want to call them that, in organizing the GM strike in 1937.
He did. He knew nothing or said nothing about the long history in decades before that, where people had been organizing at when they were getting fired and beaten up for doing that. But they did create a base for the organizing effort that was successful in 1937, and he completely dismissed that. He said they accomplished nothing because they sat around talking about socialism.
Yeah.
I think the fact that they talked about socialism and understood the class forces that they were dealing with is one of the reasons that they were able to be successful.
Very important story, that one. This, by the way, the title of the book is The Truth About the 37 Auschwitz GM Strike. The author is Tony Leah, coming out from Baraka Books. And every time we talk to you about this, Tony, it becomes more and more important and clear why it needs to be discussed. We thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Phil.
Okay.